this episode, Marvel Star Wars, issue number 49, cover dated July 1981. Hello, and welcome to Marvel Star Wars, From Empire to Jedi. We are a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. My name's the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm your host, but I am not flying solo. Every single episode, we feature a different guest host. For this episode, my co-host is an accomplished commercial artist, an award-winning comic strip writer, a book editor, blogger, podcaster, a world-class authority on the comic book character Ultra the Multi-Alien, and a noted film historian. Basically, if there was like a Jedi Council devoted to film history, he'd be the one explaining to everyone else what they did wrong. Though I'm not saying he wouldn't turn to the dark side if the snacks were better, though. And for those of you who don't listen to other shows on the Fire & Water Podcast Network, you may be surprised to discover that this gentleman, well, okay, I use that term pretty loosely here, frankly, but this gentleman has been my podcasting partner for the past 15 years. Yes, 15 years, which in podcasting terms is almost as long as the gap between Revenge of the Sith and A New Hope. And like any long-lasting relationship, you either love your partner a little more every day, or you end up bickering like an old married couple. And I will let you guess which way this relationship has gone. Folks, please help me welcome Mr. Rob Kelly. Welcome to the Rebel Base, Rob. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
Howdy, Shag. That was the nicest intro you've ever given me, and I'm sure I will ever get from you.
You are 100% correct, sir. Also, by the way, I want to wish you May the 4th be with you for this special release. We're releasing on May 4th.
Happy May the 4th. I'm very excited to be the guest on this really kind of special episode. We're dropping it on the big day.
And it's actually the one-year anniversary of the trailer of the show dropping as well. And I would love to say that I coordinated all of this specifically to have my podcast partner here for this one, but no, it's completely coincidence. And quite frankly, I would have given it to anyone. But anyway.
Thank you very much.
Of course. So we are here to talk about an issue called The Last Jedi. That's right. We're going to talk about Rey and Finn and Poe and gambling and horse racing, I guess, or whatever. No, none of that. Not that movie, nor the Legends era novel from the Coruscant Knights trilogy either. This is issue 49. This is a big one. So actually, I'm curious. Like, when I announced this show, you shockingly were nice to me and humbly asked if you could be on this episode. So I'm curious, is there a reason you picked this particular issue?
Well, as I've mentioned since you started the show, and we've talked about this on the million other podcasts we've done over the past, oh my God, 15 years, Star Wars was always my favorite Marvel comic, right? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, despite my reputation as a Richie Rich, I didn't always have a lot of money to spend. And so I had to, you know, triage, if I may use a MASH term, my comic book purchasing sometimes. And Justice League of America was always the number one book. And then a close second was Star Wars. I never missed an issue of Star Wars. And this whole run that you're covering is like my favorite run, pretty much. And this issue is just particularly really good. I think it's just really resonant. I think it's special in a lot of ways. And so, you know, I wanted to kind of call my shot early. I figured other people would ask for it. So I wanted to get in there before Brett stole it out from under me.
I'm actually really shocked because I really would have pegged you as like loving that era from like, say, issue 7 to like issue 30. Like, I figured that was your time.
I do, but you're not covering those on this show. So.
That is true. That's fair. I'm skipping them for a reason. Well, let's save the rest of this because we are going to ask you some questions about your history here. I will remind you folks at home, remember, we are not experts. We are just passionate fans. So please go gentle on us when we get things wrong. I don't know, Rob, you may not have heard this, but Star Wars fans can be a little persnickety online. I don't know if you heard that or not.
No, those are Star Trek fans. Star Wars fans are gentle and not at all misogynist chuds.
Well, not all of them, but...
No, I didn't say all of them, but...
You know. Don't insult our entire audience, please. But anyway, well, before we really get ruder to everyone listening with headphones right now...
That's what you get when you have me on the show.
I guess so. Really didn't think this through. I made a terrible mistake. Let's get to our sponsors, folks. This episode of Empire to Jedi is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode will select a collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStock Trades library, and usually it's tied into the Star Wars or the SU or something in some way, shape, or form. I pulled out the big guns and picked just about the most expensive thing I could find. I'm not genuinely saying you should buy this, people, but it's so cool I had to mention it. This is one of those giant books produced by Dynamite that are called the Art Editions. These are like the actual size of the original comic book pages. This is Walt Simonson's Battlestar Galactica Art Edition hardcover. It is also signed and has a little remark, which means like a little kind of head sketch sort of thing, by Walt Simonson. This is collecting, it's 104 pages, so it's got to be a couple of issues worth of his Battlestar Galactica run. It's scanned in high resolution color, printed at the original size. It preserves every detail of the artist's meticulous skill and hard work interpreted from the scripts. I've seen some of these artist editions. They are stunning, and it's Walt freaking Simonson. So it's a hardcover. Normally goes for, brace yourself, $400.
Oh, okay? My God.
Now, keep in mind, this is going for $400 because it's signed. It's not like it's not printed. I mean, genuinely, Walt Simonson signed this thing and did a remark in the book. That's why it's so expensive. But it's 30% off, so you could get it for the mere cost of $280, which is still very, very, very high. However, you know, to get this book and it already be signed by Walt with a little remark, that's a pretty cool deal. So I'm just saying, I didn't even know this thing existed. And I love the Battlestar Galactica comic as well, so I had to throw this in there. So, Rob, you know how the in-stock trades gimmick works. Did you happen to bring a pick, sir?
I did. I brought Star Wars Legends Epic Collection, the original Marvel Years trade paperback, Volume 6. Could that title be any longer? This collects the final run of the original Marvel series. If memory serves, I just mentioned earlier that I never missed an issue of Star Wars, but if memory serves, the last couple of years of the Marvel title, it went bi-monthly, I think.
Really?
And I could be wrong about that. I should look it up on Mike's Amazing World or something. But I from what I recall, and I can still distinctly remember back when I was still buying comics off the newsstand, like Star Wars was getting harder to find.
Yes.
Which was shocking, right? Because it's Star Wars.
Right.
But, you know, to anybody of a younger vintage, Star Wars is this pop culture monolith. But in like 1986, when the book ended, like Star Wars was kind of nothing, you know, it was like a thing of the past.
Yep.
And so issues were a little hard to find. So I remember not exactly having them all, although I do remember finding the final issues. So this collection collects Star Wars 89 through 107. And then apparently, I guess they did a 108 in 2019, which I didn't know.
You didn't know this? No. Go ahead. This is cool stuff.
I did not know that they did that, which is awesome. So this is, the writer is Ann Nesenti. The artist, Brett Blevins, one of my favorites. The cover artist is Frank Sirocco. 544 pages.
Oof.
Normal price, $54.99. In stock trades price is $35.74. You save 35%. So if you're not uber wealthy like Shag and you're buying $400 signed Walt Simonson editions, you can pick this up at least for $35.
And there's some great comics in there. You got the Lady Lumaya stuff in there, which is great. Will Spartaccio artwork, the Cynthia Martin stuff, all super fun. But yeah, issue 108. I'm talking off the top of my head. I haven't done my research here. I mean, I've got it sitting on the shelf right behind me. But basically, when Marvel got the license back, they decided to do one more issue sort of to celebrate of the original continuity. So it brings back Valens the Hunter. He fights Vader.
Oh,
I'm
that's
pretty
so
sure.
Cool. I gotta read this. This sounds awesome. I didn't know they did this.
Simonson did the cover. I don't know if he did the inside. I can't remember. He definitely did the cover though. He was definitely involved in some fashion of the creation of the issue. And it's fun. It's a nice celebration of the old Marvel stuff. And it was kind of, again, their way of saying, hey, we got the license back. So it was super
fun. By the way, I am looking at Mike's Amazing World and I am correct. The final year of the Star Wars Marvel book was bi-monthly.
Wow.
103 through 107 was every other month.
I feel like I read that in a back issue article now that you mention it, just because like they were having so many problems back then. Because like you said, Star Wars was over. You know, it was a thing of the past, right? That was the thing people were like, oh yeah, I remember that, you know, rather than it being omnipresent. And, you know, Lucasfilm was giving them a massive headache by this point of all the stuff they were or were not allowed to do. Like, it got to the point where Lucasfilm would say, like, things they couldn't do even with their own original characters. And they're like, this is our character. You know, so yeah, they wanted to be out of that deal by the end. So yeah. Anyway, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit instocktrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support, because, you know, running the Fire & Water Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services, and a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses, so we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. And quite frankly, we can't afford Rob's Yoohoo bill anyway. So, if you're enjoying shows like Marvel Star Wars From Empire to Jedi, the best way to support our show is by visiting our Patreon. Oh, wait, you know how this goes. I can ask you, what's our Patreon, Rob?
I was not expecting this. Patreon.com/FW podcast. just muscle memory at this point.
Right, exactly. And while you're there, please consider supporting the Fire & Water Podcast Network. In a certain tiers, you get mentioned on your favorite show. This episode's special thanks go out to Corellian Pirate, Al the Comics Guy, David Ace Gutierrez, Gord Tolton, and Mike Atchison. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW Podcast. Now, folks, get out on the social media, or as I like to call it, the Hollow Net. You can find us as Empire to Jedi on Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, Twitter, or X and Threads. And most importantly, leave your comments on our website, because that's where I'll be pulling your feedback to read on the air. In fact, after Rob and I talk about this comic, I'm going to read your feedback from the previous episode. As I always say, it is about building a community of online Star Wars fans around the show. Now, Rob, I know some of this just because we've been podcasting together almost as long as my daughter's been alive. But please tell me, what is your personal origin story with the Star Wars comics? And you could touch on your Star Wars background in general if you want as well.
Can I say, Abby's done a lot more with her 15 years than we have with ours, just as a side note.
So true.
No, well, I mean, look, I'm an OG fan. You know, I saw the movies when they came out. I had all the toys when they came out. I had the early bird certificate thing that, you know, the non-Kenner action figures. That, I mean, everything.
You had the cardboard box?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah.
I have memories of being in the garage when my dad was working on something, and I was building the Sears exclusive Cantina playset. I remembered we lived in a row home, and so for those of you who don't know, who knows what those are exactly, the you're kind of like, the living room is one kind of floor off the ground, so the garage is on the ground floor, obviously, and then you walk up steps. So the two houses, you know, the neighbor's house and our house, there would be this chasm between the two porches where the garages were, and I would rev my speeder toy as fast as I could to try and Evel Knievel it over to the other neighbor's thing. And sometimes I would make it, and other times I wouldn't, and it would just smash face first, hood first, into the cement wall, and damn it if that toy didn't last, right? So, I mean, I
got a question about that.
Yes.
Mine, I broke the little third nacelle, the one that sticks up off the top. Like, did yours break off?
How dare you?
I know.
No, it did not.
Mine broke off.
Those Kenner toys lasted. They went through some abuse, man.
Well, I would run around and pretend it was my comlink, because it looks like the one R3PO is holding. But anyway, please, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but please continue.
I watched the holiday special when Woo. It aired. I mean, I saw Empire when it got, like, just every big thing that a Star Wars fan could experience during those years, I did. And in fact, there's even photographic evidence of, like, when the crisis wave hit me kind of thing, because there's photos of me from my 6th birthday and my 7th birthday, and I had them in the same place. I had them up in our cabin in the Poconos, which is talked about in my long since ended Mountain Comic Show. But you see my 6th birthday, and all my decorations are Super Friends. It's all mm-hmm. Super Friends stuff, right? It's like a cake topper and a thing and blah, 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 blah. And then there's like a 6 on the can, like a 6 candle, right? And then you see the same photo with a 7, and all of a sudden I'm wearing a Darth Vader t-shirt, and there's a TIE fighter on the table. Like, it, you know what I mean? Like, that's literally when it happened. So it's just, and so of course the comic was super exciting because, you know, hey, it's further adventures of these characters back in the day when Star Wars movies were 3 years apart, which when you're a child feels like a friggin' eternity.
Right.
And I wrote an article about it on 13thdimension.com. I wrote an article called Growing Up Star Wars, where I talk about, I can remember buying Star Wars number 7 off of a newsstand. Like, I still have that memory because it was like, oh my God, there's more Han Solo. There's more Star Wars. Like, it was so exciting. So yeah, it's just every experience an original Star Wars fan could had, I had it during those years.
Well, I remember you telling me that story many times at various podcasts about, because for those of you who don't remember the original run of the comic, the issues 1 through 6 was the adaptation. So issue 7 yep. was the first original story. And I remember you telling me the story, if I remember right, you were in a mall when you bought the comic yep. and mm-hmm. you were reading it, and you would like literally be walking into people because you were so engrossed yep. in the comic book.
Yep. There was a mall called the Gallery, mm-hmm. and there was a newsstand in it, and my parents bought me the comic 35 whole cents, and I just was immersed in it, and they had to like literally steer me around people because my face was buried in this, because again it was so exciting. And I remember my mom bought clothes. I remember that, and they went to this department store, and I remembered the clerk as she was trying on whatever she was trying on, the clerk literally said, "Wow, he's really engaged in this," or something to that. Like, he remarked that as a little child, I was not making a peep because I was so, it was like, oh my God, this is so exciting. So I still can't still remember that.
That's incredible. I love that story. And I'm excited because my first Star Wars issue, well, the first one I really started getting into it was the next issue we're going to cover, issue 50. So I know that energy and excitement you felt because I was there too. So I got to ask you now, Rob, and I've got a guess, and I've already kind of hinted at you in our messages what my guess is. So who is your favorite Star Wars expanded universe character? And when I say expanded universe, we can, you know, anything outside of the movies and TV shows, right? So like we can talk about comics, novels, role-playing games. It could be from that holiday, beloved holiday special. It could be this, you know, Pee-wee Herman from the Star Tours ride, you know, whatever. So what do you got?
I know you're expecting me to say Valance the Hunter.
I am expecting you to say Valance the Hunter.
Because he's an awesome character, right? I absolutely loved it. But I'm gonna cheat a little.
Oh,
with my answer. My answer is from Star Wars number 28.
Okay.
The Marvel version of Jabba the Hutt.
Wait,
yellow skin and the mutton chops. And the reason I bring that up is because, again, the appeal of the Star Wars comic when there was only one movie every 3 years is you were just desperate. Like the Marvel comic filled such a gap, right? Because it took the world and expanded it. I mean, I read Splinter of the Mind's Eye. You know, I read there was the Star Wars comic in, I think it was Dynamite, right? That was the original Star Wars.
Pizzazz, actually.
Pizzazz, excuse me, not Dynamite, Pizzazz. I just, every micron of Star Wars material that I could find, I was hoovering up at the time. And so the idea that Star Wars, the comic, would show us a character only mentioned in the movie but never shown was like such a like, ooh, I'm getting like inside information. Now, of course, you know, eventually he would appear in the movies. But back then, I'm shocked that Lucas let them do that because as we know that he was so tight-fisted.
Right.
I am shocked. They slipped that by. But nevertheless, I remember getting that issue and being like, that's what Jabba looks like. It blew my mind. And then, you know, I got old enough to when the Jedi came out, I was like, all right, now that's really what he looks like. Marvel was just kind of papering over. But that to me is like, that's the sort of like the charming appeal of the Star Wars comic was that they could sort of fill in this little gap because you're like, we know you want to see Jabba the Hutt. So here's Jabba the Hutt, even though he looks nothing like the Jabba the Hutt we have all come to know and love.
Right. And I'm sure in 19, that would have been like 78 or so when they did that, or 79, you know, Lucasfilm was just thinking about Empire at that point. They probably weren't even thinking about Jedi. And so it was like, yeah, sure, we don't care if you do Jabba, whatever. You know, we're not going to use him. And then, obviously, with the other direction. It's funny you mentioned that. That's a great pick, by the way. And I don't know if that's genuinely your favorite character or it's just your most fun niche. I don't care. It's awesome.
It's what I think of when I think of the comic book.
Oh, that's
cool. Like, of all, if you're asking, you're like, I think of Star Wars number 7 when I think of the comic because it's the first one. But in specific to this question, I had to think about it. I'm like, what's the character that first pops in my head? And it's really, I can remember buying the comic and being like, that's what Jabba, like it was like hugely important that that's what Jabba the Hutt looked like, that I learned that. And it felt like I had, again, like I felt like I had inside info because it was like, not everybody's reading the comic. I am. So I know what Jabba the Hutt looks like. But you nerds, you're losing out. I know what Jabba looks like. It's very important.
I came across that comic later. I bought the comic issue, starting around issue 15, stuck with it well into the 60s, you know, for about a year and a half or so. Then Return of the Jedi comes out. Then in sixth grade, so this is after Return of the Jedi's come out, I go to middle school and I go to band. And after band, you have to go, your parents pick you up from school. Well, my mom didn't get off till 5, so I had to kill time. So I'd finish band practice and I'd go across the street to the public library and I would just chill out in the library for an hour or two. And they had a selection of really old comics. And that one was there. And I remember reading it because, again, this is post-return now and it's still sitting on the shelves. I pick it up. I'm like, ooh, Star Wars. Okay, I'll read some more of these. I'm like, what the holy hell is this? Because Jabba, I mean, to me, my memory is he basically kind of looks like a walrus man, really, just but he with does, mutton chops.
Yeah.
So that was always such a mind blower for me, especially since since I had seen Return at that point, and it just I remember thinking, these comics are crazy. Now, of course, I appreciate what they were trying to do, but as fun, that's a great pick. That is wonderful. I'm glad you did that. Good call.
I'm glad I was able to zag when you thought I was going to zag.
I was bragging on him earlier. I'm like, I will be completely surprised when you pick Valiant the Hunter. I was trying to be like sarcastic and everything. Oh, well.
I'm keeping this relationship fresh.
I tell you. All right, let's get into this. This is Star Wars number 49, published by Marvel Comics, cover dated July 1981, on the shelves April 21st, 1981. Cover price is 50 cents, two shiny quarters. And the cover is by, oh, bless it, Walt Simonson. Wow. Rob, you want to describe the cover for us?
Beautiful piece. I mean, look, it's as you just said, it's Walt Simonson. He never did a bad art job in his life. So therefore, you know, it's already really good. But one of the things, if I may get on my old man shakes his fist at the Death Star, is I look at modern comics and they're just all poster covers, right? They're just all poster covers. And it drives me nuts. I like it when the covers are like story centric. And this is like a combo of that, but it's also like a movie poster a little bit because it's got multiple pieces. They're not all these elements are there in reality. You've got Luke with his lightsaber. You've got a Y-wing fighter. You've got Leia laying in the grass. A pretty busty Leia laying in the grass. you've got this alien that you don't know who that is over on the left with this big stick. And then you see this clearly this female Empire official in a surprint. Woo-hoo! In the background. Surprints follow us wherever we go, Shaq. And then you've got the star pattern in the background. So it's a poster cover, but it's also about the story. So I think it's really very striking.
That's fair. No, that's a good description. And a couple different things I want to point out. Like the background is all this bluish purple star fields. So you see lots of stars and planets in the background. And I love that they made the Star Wars logo hollow. So you've got the white border around Star Wars, but you can see through the letters and into the background, which looks really, really sharp. And there is a lot of color on this cover. Okay. Mm-hmm. A lot. Like you mentioned, the Imperial officer in the background, she's a bright magenta, you know, pink almost, if you will. Then you've got that purple I mentioned. Then you've got the orangish yellow Marvel Comics Group logo. You've got all the different colored characters. You got the Y-Wing, which has got the red highlights. I mean, it's a lot of color, but for whatever reason, it all just comes together beautifully for me. I think the colors actually work. A few of them are even a little day glowish, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like it's overcolored?
No. It's got a lot of pops to it, but it's, again, it's so well designed.
Yeah.
Like I like that the trail of the vapor trail of the Y-Wing fighter is breaking the, but you know, there's like a panel border.
Yeah.
Almost. So then you've got a thing at the bottom. By the way, during our adventures on Whoso, I must have explained this at some point. You know how they do the star field, right? Do you know how artists get that effect?
I mean, I guess they would just take
digital.
I would guess they just take a brush, get a little bit of white paint on it, and flick it, I would think.
That's pretty much it. We were taught this at the Joe Kubert School. Yes, I'm mentioning the Joe Kubert School. I got to get that in.
There's an ad for the Joe Kubert School here in the original comic.
Awesome. We would take white out, mm-hmm, because it was the right consistency, and you layer it on a toothbrush.
Oh.
And then you run your thumb along the bristles and it splatters in a way that's kind of random like that, and so that's how you get the effect.
That's freaking cool. That's amazing. So I guess you would have to do that first and then paint over it, I guess.
I'm guessing they did that on a separate piece of paper.
Okay.
And like an overlay, and that's maybe where the surprint is or something like that. But yeah, there's a couple pieces to this cover for certain, because that's the line art is sitting on top of it, and then you've got the planets that are separate color hold. So mm-hmm, they went an extra mile on this one. Between this one and number 50, they went the kind of extra mile, but I'm sure Star Wars was making them some good coin at this point.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because like last issue was a Carmen Infantino cover, which is unfortunately not a favorite cover of mine at all. But then 1 month later on the stands, you get this. And then you mentioned issue 50, which we'll talk about next month, which is a stunning cover. I feel like at this point, starting right here, they're trying to make a statement about the direction of future Star Wars comics, like trying to say, you know, we're doing something different now, because this just feels so different than what they've been putting on the cover again for the last month or even before that. So it really is something new and different. So a couple different things I want to shout out at is the lightsaber. Luke's got a yellow lightsaber, so represent Kenner. Nice, love that. And I did not see this at first, so I will give full credit to the online community. So you see the surprint of the Imperial officer in the background, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have commented that it looks like Freddie Mercury because the shadowing effect on her upper lip.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Which is supposed to be sort of a pouty lip. Instead, it looks like his mustache.
I've got to break free. Yeah,
and once you see it, you kind of can't unsee it, unfortunately. So I'm sorry if I ruined the cover for
you. Oh, you ruined
anybody.
This cover for... Oh, thank you. Oh, now I regret doing the show. Oh.
Well, you were going to... That was going to happen anyway. Let's be honest.
That was going to happen at some point. Yeah. Might as well get to it early.
Speaking of other colors, like, you know, I mentioned the yellow lightsaber. Jedediah is green on the cover, but he's purple throughout the issue. That's not really here or there, a big deal. But I do love the corner box. It's the same as it's been for the last couple months. It's C-3PO and R2, drawn by Al Williamson and Carlos Gazan. When I think of Marvel Star Wars, that's actually the first thing that pops in my head, is that corner box. Like, that corner box means Marvel Star Wars to me, because it's on pretty much every cover. So I adore it. And it says Last Jedi right on the cover. Again, nothing to do with the movie. And, you know, the reader here is going to assume that's Luke, but shh, don't spoil it, but he's not the Last Jedi. So there we go. All right, getting inside, writer is Mike W. Barr. Artists are, it's listed specifically as artists, Walt Simonson and Tom Palmer. Now, Mike's Amazing World lists them as penciler and inker, but based on my research of what I've been reading, it was probably more like Simonson was on pencils, maybe loose pencils, and Palmer was on finishes and inks, I think is what's really going on. But anyway, letter is Shelley Lefferman. Colorist is Don Warfield and Christy Scheele. Editor is Louise Jones, who will go on to become Louise Simonson. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. And then editor in chief is Jim Shooter. However, he is listed as Empire Liaison. And the sort of funny, ironic thing about that, especially since he's an editor, is they spelled liaison wrong. So,
oh, they did, didn't they? Yeah, that's funny.
That's a big whoops.
By the way, saying that he's a member of the Empire is a joke and also not a joke.
Right. No, I get you. Yep. No, that's fair. Absolutely fair. I'm sure they knew what they were doing when they wrote that. All right. So, issue is called The Last Jedi, but not that one. All right. So, Luke, Leia, and everyone's favorite droids respond to a distress call and rescue Prince Danid of Velmor. He's an exiled royal with a tragic past, a lost love, a wrecked ship, and a loyal advisor named Jedediah, who isn't exactly playing with a full sabacc deck. Now, the rebels hatch a bold plan to return Prince Danid home, spark a rebellion there, and do it all with some delightfully wacky disguises. And on Velmor, it's a rogues gallery of the oily regent, Zelor, the power-hungry brother Anod, and the ever-charming imperial femme fatale, Captain Trail. Tossing some swashbuckling energy sword duels and space fox hunts while riding giant space frogs. But the real heart of the story is Jedediah. He's written off by everyone, but he proves to be the true hero and teaches Luke a powerful lesson about judging by appearances. Now, we're going to get into a lot more detail on this as we go through it, but let's just talk big picture. First off, I mean, obviously you enjoyed the issue, but what do you got some for big picture thoughts here?
You know, as a kid, I wasn't making a lot of parallels to real life out of Star Wars. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It was just a fantasy adventure. When you're a kid, you want to see the good guys, you know, defeat the bad guys, unless you're like a sociopath or something. But like, that's what you want and that's what you get out of it. And Star Wars delivers that really effectively. And, you know, that's what made it so, with great characters, it made it so compelling. Occasionally, the book would wander into, you know, parallels of real life. But as a kid, I wasn't picking. I mean, you know, when I was 12, I wasn't getting that, like, the Ewoks or the Viet Cong. Like, I didn't understand any of those things, you know. So I just enjoyed it for what it was. But this issue has, and as, you know, as we all get older and some of us are experiencing this in our real life, like, I liked the idea of the reality of, like, well, what would it be like if a Jedi was really old and went senile? Mm-hmm. Like, what is that? What is, like, it's the, like, Star Wars is so surface on purpose. And then, you know, and if you pick apart some of the stuff, you're like, wait, that makes no sense. But it's the nitty gritty of taking the time to say, we're going to go off to this corner of the universe and talk about this Jedi character who is dealing with the reality of his brain is partly gone. I just thought that was a really fascinating idea, you know, and most of the time the comic was just delivering adventure in high style, but this has like a little dollop of, you know, realism and pathos that I just always thought was really effective.
Interesting. I never really thought about it as aging. I always drew a correlation, and I haven't really seen other people talk. I mean, sure, somebody out there has talked about it, but I've always drew analogies to Don Quixote. Like, this feels like a very Don Quixote situation where he's not really in touch with the world that we are. you know, he's seeing the world as a fantasy. He's not running around with a lightsaber. He's running around with a stick. You know, he thinks he's defending, you know, the prince or the realm. In reality, he's just kind of a crazy dude. So I saw it more as a Don Quixote thing, which then also sort of extrapolates into one of my loves, which is the role-playing game, Star Wars role-playing game by West End Games. They actually developed a template that you could play called the Chaotix Jedi. And it wasn't this character, but the idea was someone who was a little off kilter, who thought that they were super in touch with the Jedi, but really it was just like some drunk in the corner. And he's like, no, I feel it in the Force. Pass me that booze, you know, whatever. But that's how I always viewed this, was more through a lens of Don Quixote. I don't know. Maybe I'm seeing something that only I'm seeing. I don't know.
See, but now I've never read. I mean, I know the story, but I've never read that. But like, is he addled, or is he just in his own fantasy world?
I actually haven't read it either. I just know from what I understand.
Because Jedediah here is addled.
Yeah.
Because they talk about that he got hit in the head.
Right.
With those rocks. And so I always, even as a small child, I took it as, this is a senior citizen. He's, you know, maybe the character isn't literally considered a senior, but I always took it as he is a, like, he's like your grandpa,
right,
who isn't all there anymore. Well, what would that be like if he had been a Jedi?
Interesting.
That kind of, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. And he thought he was still a Jedi. Like, I just found that fascinating.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I love it. It's a great, great way to look at it. So I got some other big picture notes I wanted to share. One is that, you know, in the covers of this podcast, you know, this is our fifth issue we've covered after Empire Strikes Back. So, you know, of the new original stories, this is our fifth one. The previous four issues all took the time to focus on a small subset of the Star Warriors. Like, we had one issue on Luke, we had one issue on Lando and Chewie, we had one issue on the droids, we had one issue with Leia. So if you combine the 6 months of the Empire adaptation, plus those 4 months of like spotlight issues, the editors successfully spun their wheels and killed almost the first year of comic book time, knowing they've got to fill 3 years of content before they can answer any of the questions that are left hanging. So pretty smart on their part to do that. And this is the first issue since Empire where our Star Warriors are mostly back together. So this is kind of the beginning of, again, a new era, like we were saying those. And also in those five previous issues, amongst those, or we count this one as the fifth, we've already had four different writers. We've had Archie Goodwin, J.M. DeMatteis, Larry Hama, and now Mike W. Barr. And surprisingly, this is Mike W. Barr's only Star Wars issue he's going to write for Marvel. He does write a couple more Star Wars issues for Dark Horse, but all told, it's it. And at this time, in 1981, he was writing a lot of books for DC, like Mystery in Space and Unexpected, and some superheroes. But Batman the Outsiders were still 2 years away. I thought Mike W. Barr did a really nice job with this issue. What do you think?
Oh, I'm an unabashed Mike W. Barr fan from Batman and the Outsiders and his other stuff on Batman. I've just always loved him. So the fact that he did this as his one issue of Star Wars and I love it so much is okay. I love that guy. I always thought he brought just an inventiveness to all the Batman and the Outsider stuff. I never missed that book. So I just remain a big fan of his work.
And he did an interview for Back Issue Magazine back in 2005, an article written by Glenn Greenberg. And he said in there, this was probably one of his top 10 favorite comic stories that he'd done. So that says a lot with considering how many comic books that man has written.
Yeah, it's great stuff. Yeah, it's really good.
Just a couple more things. So Rob and I are looking at a version that has been touched up of the comic. I don't know what you folks, if you're reading along, if you're reading at home, I don't know whether you're reading digitally or the original comic, but the original printed edition is absolutely horrible looking. The printing is so bad on the original edition. In fact, Walt Simonson, here's a quote from him from that same Star Wars back issue article. He says, this particular issue, issue 49, has one of the two worst jobs of printing I've ever had in four color comics. It was pretty awful and depressing when it came out. And as Rob pointed out to me before we got started here, you know, the old comics, they just get worse looking with age.
Yeah, so the newsprint just ages really horribly.
So it even looks worse now than it did back then. But yeah, I mean, it's so bad. I read the printed comic the first time, and then I immediately switched over to Marvel Unlimited because when they did the original reprints of this, which was for Dark Horse, now it's with Marvel, it's so clean, it's so pretty, it's so gorgeous. So if you're reading the original comic, do yourself a favor, seek out a reprint or the digital version because it looks so much better.
The splash page especially, right? Like, they're already like kind of leaving their mark.
Oh my gosh.
Right at the beginning with this wonderful drawing of the Y-Wing fighter over the planet and all that detail. It's so beautiful.
And you know, I think about that particular splash page. It's as you, Rob said, it's a Y-Wing flying away from you. So it's an incredible perspective shot. And I wonder how much of that is Simonson and how much of that is Palmer. Because Tom Palmer did some really interesting stuff where he really wanted to get all the ships right. And he was really focused on that. So he actually went out to the store, bought a bunch of the model kits that Star Wars had produced. He glued them all together, and then he had his son hold them up in different poses, and he would photograph them. And if they weren't showing up properly, he would get out I can never say this. You always rapidapen. How do you say that?
Rapidograph.
Thank you. He'd get out one of those to darken certain areas so it showed up better in the photographs, and he would take photos at all these different angles. So his son's in all the photos, right? And he would use those as photo reference. And I'm looking at this thing and knowing that Tom Palmer probably did a lot of the finishes here, that this is probably more Palmer than Simonson, I'm thinking, as far as just all the detail work.
Maybe. Can you imagine, right, that I know your dad was in TV, so your dad had kind of a cool job, but like, can you imagine, like, that's your dad's job?
Right.
Like, let's go to the model store and buy a bunch of Star Wars models and put them together and take funny pictures. That's my dad working.
Right.
The coolest job in the world. I bet I don't know his son's name, but I'm like, probably the way the world works, his son was probably like, had a bunch of friends that didn't like Star Wars, and they're like, who cares? He's like, what are you talking about? This is the coolest thing ever.
Could very well be. I think his son works in the comic industry now, actually.
Good for him.
Now, I can't help wondering... This issue, you love it. I love it. I didn't read it originally. I've only read it, you know, after the fact. But I keep wondering, like, what would have happened if Carmine was still drawing the series? Would we have loved this story as much?
No.
Okay, straight up.
Okay. I can tell you, right? No, I wouldn't. I'd still think it was a good story, but it would not be, to me, a classic the way it is, thanks to the artwork.
I think so, too. Yeah. And there's some crazy stuff in here, I mean, in which Carmine would have gone nuts for. I mean, like, there's laser lances and space fox hunts and space giant frogs and all this crap. It's totally giving medieval vibes. But to me, that still works in the realm of space fantasy. So I think it works quite well.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about this, or I've talked about it in the comments to your previous episodes, is like, any given issue of this series, the amount of percentage in any given issue that was like felt Star Warsy versus Marvel, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's like you could sort of feel some issues where like the Marvel-ishness of it sloshes over to like the 50%, you know? Then you're all right, this is like some of those creatures that Carmen Infantino draw, you're like, that's a Marvel. That's a character. I saw Doctor Strange fight that guy. Now, come on. It doesn't look like Star Wars. This to me, even though it's a big adventure story and you've kind of like this pirate guy kind of, this feels like a Star Wars story just happened to be told by Marvel. It's not a Marvel story set in the Star Wars universe.
I'm really glad you made that distinction, because I hadn't thought about that till now. Because I've often said that Carmine is not necessarily my favorite artist on Star Wars. However, I always give him credit because he wasn't hired to be a Star Wars artist. He was hired to be a Marvel artist drawing Star Wars, which is what made them all so dynamic, everything you just described. And you know, this is probably the delineation point right here, where everything before this was more, maybe not the Empire adaptation, but everything before this was really a Marvel comic, and everything after this is a Star Wars comic. That may that may be a fair distinction to make. So that's pretty insightful coming out of you, Mr. Kelly. I'm impressed.
I see. I'm bringing it over here.
Well, it had to happen once. All right.
It only took 15 years.
Right.
Finally got there.
So we're going to cover this in chunks. We've got it broken down into four different patches here. So first off, flying the cosmos's biggest Y-Wing ever is Luke Skywalker. On board is Princess Leia, Organa, R2-D2, and C-3PO. They're following a beacon to a wild jungle world to find lost royalty. So here enters Prince Denid, stranded for years after a tragic crash that claimed his betrothed. Along with the prince is his brain-damaged ally, Jedediah, who was a could-have-been Jedi. They've been surviving against the odds, but time is up and Denid needs to reclaim his throne before his empire-loving brother swoops in. So Luke blows up the prince's old wreck of a spaceship, and it's all aboard the Y-Wing to return the prince to his adoring public. So we've already talked about this splash page. It is absolutely stunning. I'll put this out on social media as well so you guys can see it. Wow, wow, wow. But then, you know, they land and Luke has to fight this giant purple creature, like big purple people eater. What do you think?
I love the design of it. I love that he tries to slice its hand off, because this is a Star Wars story after all. And I love that he mentions this worked on that snow beast on Hoth.
Uh-huh.
It's like he's always bringing up, like, you know, he's like a guy that played football in high school and he's still talking about it 30 years later. You're like, all right, Luke, I know. Okay. You know what I mean? Like, he's just sort of like, you know, I mean, in another way, if this was more Marvel-y, there would be a little asterisk, and it's like, and there'd be a little, like, you know, as seen in Empire Strikes Back, rascally, you know, rascally Roy or something like that. I mean, I just kind of like that we have to, like, get a mention of Empire Strikes Back. It's almost like you could tell Luke is one of those guys who's like, well, you know, I did blow up the Death Star. Like, yeah, all right. You know, okay.
Luke peaked 8 months ago. Sorry, folks.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that this guy looks like a giant Muppet. He looks like Sweetums or something like that. Like, I can imagine...
Where are you all going?
Right. I can imagine, you know, the Henson Workshop making this character for the film. It works for me. I love it. The hand thing's a little weird. Like, he cuts off the hand and it grows right back. And then later on they tell you it takes an anti-magnetic polarization, blah, blah, blah.
Blah, 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 yeah. Blah.
They never explain beyond that, but I guess that's kind of cool sci-fi stuff. Whatever. Cool. Sure. Okay, oh, you know what? I skipped over the most important thing with the Y-Wing. How the F do they all fit inside? Okay, you know the Y-Wing. We both grew up there. Y-Wing is a one-person plane, right? One-person starfighter. How the heck does Luke, Leia, R2, 3PO, all of them fit comfortably, and we'll see there's even more room later, inside this Y-Wing? What is up with that?
But the head of the ship is pretty big, right? I guess the cockpit is a little small, but yeah.
It's a one-man ship. It's no bigger than an X-Wing. I mean, I guess so. Yeah. And now, they do say it's a modified Y-Wing, which by this means, since it is the exact same proportions as a regular Y-Wing, this thing just has to be like 8 times as big as a regular Y-Wing is what it means. So the real question is, who messed up here, right? was it Mike W. Barr who put it in the script and says they're flying a Y-Wing? Or was it Walt Simonson who's like, I want to draw a Y-Wing? And like Tom Palmer's like, oh my gosh, I got to do everything I can to save this, even though I know that only one person...
This is incorrect, Mr. Barr, the Y-Wing. Did you have a Y-Wing, by the way? The Kenner toy?
No, I didn't. Okay. I didn't have an X-Wing or the Millennium Falcon. Thank you.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to bring up things that are uncomfortable.
I had Vader's TIE Fighter. That's the only ship I had. And a Land Speeder, I guess. I had that too.
Okay.
I had the Death Star. That's something, I guess.
Me too, yeah.
I still have the little creature and everything. So
do you really still have the real? Oh, that's great.
So the foam, you know what happens after 40 years? It looks fine until you touch it, and then it disintegrates like a vampire killed on Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Oh, yeah. Poof. Like all the moisture, like whatever moisture is in there, it whittles away. Yeah.
So weird. All right. So getting back into this. All right. So these pages, I think that Simonson's jungle is sort of evocative of Al Williamson's jungle work that he used to do like in Flash Gordon. And then he did in The Empire Strikes Back. I don't know if you're getting that vibe too, but that's kind of what I was feeling when I was seeing this.
I haven't really thought about it. You know, it looks real. Well, you know what I mean? Of course, again, it's Walt Simonson. Of course, it looks good.
So, did you notice anything strange about Luke's lightsaber?
It's
that he has one. Because it should be at the bottom of the shaft on Bespin.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, you're right. He lost. Yeah, well, you know what? He went and got another one. I mean, for Pete's sakes.
I mean, this is the second time we've seen him since Empire. He's had a lightsaber the whole time. I mean, it's a fun, nerdy nitpick, but at the same time, it's like, I wouldn't want to read a story about Luke without a lightsaber.
Yeah,
so,
exactly. Sure. And if you were Luke and you were given the coolest weapon in the history of all fiction, you'd be like, I'm going to get another one, damn it. I don't come on.
I love now retroactively how, you know, when Obi-Wan goes, your father wanted you to have this, like, that's such a bald-faced lie. And we know Anakin was losing lightsabers every 30 seconds. So, like, that particular saber was meaningless to him. So, Luke.
Nah, yeah, they were just cranking them out. Come on. Exactly. I mean, there is that deleted scene in Return of the Jedi where we see that he's built a new lightsaber. And that's supposedly, like, the acceleration of his powers, right? Yep. His Jedi power. But that's not in the movie. So, therefore, it's not canon. So, you could say, well, Luke is building his own lightsabers at this point.
Oh, okay. That works. All right. I like the no prize. All right. We'll put that in the mail to you.
Okay. Thank you.
So Prince Danage shows up. I don't even know if I'm saying that right. But anyway, Prince Danage shows up looking like Vandal Savage from DC Comics there. And WTF, Leia suddenly turns into a 14-year-old girl crushing on the prince. Like, he shows up. She's like, I'm Leia. He's Luke. We're from the Rebel Alliance. And if you're Prince Danage of Velmor, we've come a long way to find you. And it was worth the trip. And she's like, got googly eyes. It looks like out of a romance comic. She's like smiling, side-eyeing him. She's leaning on her wrist. I mean, it's ridiculous how much she's gone goo-goo for him.
That's what I like about it, right? Is that they're reduced to kind of being, because they were still not, we still, obviously we didn't know that they were siblings yet. But even though Luke is sort of jealous romantically, they're acting like siblings a little bit. And that's what I kind of like. I like that it's goofy. I like that it lightens up. By the way, if this character, Prince Danid, had appeared in the movie when this comic was made, this would have been played by Kevin Kline. I think they absolutely would have
Kevin
cast
Kline.
Kevin
Kline. Really?
Kevin Kline. Yes.
Okay.
I think because he would have been doing that kind of like Pirates of Penzance kind of adventurer guy that he was doing in movies at the time. So I think that would have been Kevin Kline.
Okay. I'm not usually into the fan casting. I'm forced to do it on my Blue Devil show, but I'm not good at it. So I hadn't thought about that. I probably would have gone for a more rugged guy, I guess, because he looks so rugged here, but I don't know.
He needs to be a little overly charming so you can root for Luke, who's like rolling his eyes. Because you're like, oh, come on. You know what I mean? It's that kind of thing.
The Luke squinting panel next to Leia turning into a 14-year-old girl is very funny. It is very funny.
Yeah.
So then we meet Jedediah, who's like this sort of insectoid alien. He's got little phalanges coming off his arms. He's got, looks like three fingers, maybe. I don't know. And he's, you know, a crazy sort of alienistic face with bug eyes and hair and stuff like that. To me, it's giving very proto Beta Ray Bill vibes. Are you getting that too?
Yes. Oh, yeah. He has like, okay. He looks like a Beta Ray Bill mixed with a xenomorph.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, I can see that. Definitely with the headpiece and everything like that. Yeah. And there's another moment here too where Luke is like, no, it can't be. And they show Jedediah and he's like, he's a Jedi Knight. And it's like, what?
Yeah, I don't know where Luke, how does he get to that? I don't understand.
It's an alien holding a stick. Yeah. I mean, that's all it is. Like, they do, in the caption boxes, they try to rescue this point by saying that, you know, he's clothed in the outfit that is, it just basically says that the clothes are what a Jedi used to wear. And I'm looking at these clothes, I'm like, this is absolutely, like, nothing Obi-Wan wore. And that's the only Jedi Luke ever met. So what the hell are they talking about?
Say in the panel, Prince Dini needs Jedediah. Jedi will protect him. So he refers to himself as a Jedi. And of course, he, as they mentioned in the next panel, he isn't. They asked him to be one, but he turned them down. So he's like the Phantom Stranger of the Jedi.
He is. And by the way, I don't think he's calling himself a Jedi. I think he's calling himself Jedi, like part of his name. Like, your name is Robert and we call you Rob.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's how I read that.
Oh, okay. So, I never really thought about that. Okay.
So, and that's a question for you. Is that name, is that a little too much? A little too on the nose? Jedi?
Right. They could have probably given. And plus, it's not a very alien sounding name. Like, Jedi is a name that we're familiar with. Like, they could have called him, you know, any of the crazy Star Wars names. But yeah, maybe that's a little on the nose, but I don't know. I dig it. I love that panel of him looking up as he's about to get hit in the head with the rock. Like, it's just, there's something about that. I just love that he's like about to, his whole life's about to change. And then you see the hand sticking up out of the rubble. It's great stuff.
It's very sad. It looked kind of a good Marvel pose with that action, but yeah.
Yep.
So interesting. You mentioned the alien and all that stuff. You know, when you do a podcast, folks, you have to read these things a lot. And so I've read this issue probably three or four times this week. And I realized something on one of my last reads, which was in the script alone, they actually never call him an alien. There is no reference anywhere in this book about him being an alien. In fact, there's times where they use the word man to describe him. Another doctor looks at him and says the human brain, referring to him, blah, 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 blah.
Mm.
I'm wondering if Simonson got the script and just decided to make Jedediah an alien because he thought it would be more interesting. And I think that was the right choice. But I don't know that Barr intended for this to be an alien. I think he intended to be, like you said, an old man.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. The word human is very specific. Yeah.
So crazy stuff. All right, well, let's move on. So then, after a few days traveling in this spacious Y-Wing, where Princess Leia and the Prince get cozy, they arrive on Velmor. They arrive just in the nick of time, disrupting the coronation of Prince Anod, who's the slimy, empire-loving brother of Prince Danid. And I'm going to say his name different every time. Their arrival throws the coronation into chaos. Meanwhile, Luke Skywalker and Princess Leia roll into Valor in full disguise. Luke is a shady bounty hunter called Cole Marcus, and Leia posing as the prince's betrothed, Lauren. So the Velmor citizens may cheer Prince Danid's return, but not everyone's celebrating. Regent Zalor and the scheming Imperial Captain Trall have their own power plays brewing. So starting this section off, did you notice the boom tubes that they're flying through?
I love the way Simonson draws hyperdrive. That it's a flat surface that they're just zipping. I love it.
And I've heard a lot of people online like have a fit about it, how it's like a portal or whatever. I don't, it's a comic, man. How are you going to draw them going into hyperspace as effectively? This is so effective and it looks so cool. And it does look like boom tubes. I love it. I absolutely adore
it. It's great. People online have fits just because they're online. So don't worry about it.
That is true. That is true. Now, they talk about how they spend days in hyperspace, which isn't something that happens too often in comics. And Prince Danid totally macking on Leia here, and that's going to continue to get worse and worse. I mean, again, this Y-Wing is so ridiculously big. They are standing up. They are lounging around. They actually refer to it as, I think, luxurious at one point, or civilized comforts.
It's like a deluxe Y-Wing.
Yes. And there's room for Jedi or Jedediah and 3PO to sword for practice and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. This thing's as big as the Millennium Falcon. I'm sorry. It just makes no sense.
To get the little chessboard and everything.
Right, exactly. So they land the ship in the middle of the coronation crowd. I mean, he flies into baseball or football stadium sized crowd, and Luke just parks his Y-Wing. He does not give a poo-doo, man. He is coming in hot. So what do you think of these disguises here what is it called? Cole Marcus and Lauren.
Yeah, I love it. I love them going undercover. It's fun, right? I wish there had been a Star Wars TV series, these are the kind of adventures they would have gone on. The one tiny, this isn't even a complaint because it's not, but it would have been funny if Luke in this role had talked like Han Solo. Like that's what his version of a brigand was. You know, he's like, I can imagine an awful lot. You know what I mean? Like, he just started talking like Han because he was like, well, I don't know. That's what pirates talk like, right? You know, that would have been a little funny to throw that in, but it's not a complaint.
Call everyone kid. Yeah, that exactly. Would have worked really well. I like that. Yeah. And this sort of continues the trend here. I mean, you know, we've got the first movie, Luke and Han dress up as stormtroopers. And then, now they don't know this, but in Return of the Jedi, Leia's going to dress as a bounty hunter and Lando's the skiff guard. So it actually sort of works in the mythos of Star Wars is to dress up in silly costumes.
Sure.
And this, it's interesting. Luke as this character here is sort of interesting in that I recognized this immediately. To me, it was itching me. I had to look it up online to see if anyone else felt this way. The disguise that Luke is wearing actually looks a little bit like a disguise Lando will adopt many months down the line. Lando adopts a disguise as Captain Drebble in an issue. And they're both wearing berets. They're both wearing eye patches. They're both, you know, supposed to be, you know, bad people out there. And it's sort of interesting how similar it is. And then you look deeper and you're like, oh, wait, Tom Palmer inked both of those issues. So I don't know whether Lando's recycling a costume or just Tom Palmer has a type. I don't know which it is, but it made me happy that I wasn't the only one who had seen that.
Pirates are fun to draw.
Yes. Totally agree. Then, let's see, Captain Trawl. So you've got this sexy, you know, kind of femme fatale sort of Imperial. She's the only Imperial on the whole planet, by the way. We don't see a single stormtrooper. We don't see any Imperial guards, nothing. It's just her. But I like when they meet her, they introduce her, and she says, delighted. And the word balloon is actually dripping with icicles.
The drippy word balloon.
I love that. And this is sort of progressive for the comics, too, because this is the second female command officer we've met in the last couple of months. There was a female command officer in Dreams of Cody Sunchild as well. So I don't think we ever saw a female command officer in any of the original trilogy. So I think it's pretty forward of them to do that.
Women can be evil, too.
Oh, what are you trying to say, Mike W. Barr? And then, you know, you get this scene where the prince is tested to make sure he's legitimate, that he's actually who he says he is. And they confirm the results. And there's these three guys. There's no page numbers on here, so I can't direct you to the page. But there's these three guys that test the prince, and they confirm the prince is correct. But, like, Simonson just had a really fun time drawing these three weird-looking dudes. And I can't help, like, are they Ugnaughts or something? Like, who are they?
They look a little Ugnaughty, right? Yeah. They're you know, human-colored, but they look a little, the two guys especially, look a little Ugnaughty.
And then I started wondering, is it based on the Three Stooges or something? Like, I don't know. I feel like there's a Star Wars short story. Like, they do those anthologies. I feel like there's just a short story waiting to be told with these three guys, and I want to read it very, very badly now.
Who are those two guys? The Tag and Bink? Or what are those guys?
Yeah. There
it's
you
like
go.
That, right?
Yeah. All right, moving on to the next section here. So later, there's a banquet held in honor of the prince's return, and Regent Zellor challenges Luke. Now, keep in mind, Luke is still dressed as the bounty hunter Cole Marcus. He challenges Luke to a duel with energy swords. Regent Zellor seems to be fighting to the death, so Luke lets Zellor win the duel, ensuring to save himself. Unfortunately, not his pride, though he lands on his butt. Later, Luke gets cornered by the femme fatale Imperial operator, Captain Trawl, who drops the act and says, yeah, you know, why you're, I know you're a fake. And her price for her to keep silent is a casual double assassination of Prince Danid and his love, Lauren, during tomorrow's ceremonial hunt. Meanwhile, the backstabber-in-chief, Regent Zalor, is plotting even bigger. He wants to wipe out everyone, including Prince Danid, Leia, Prince Anod, the Imperial Captain, everyone. He wants to be the last one standing. I mean, this is like Game of Thrones-level betrayal going on here. So the sword fight, what'd you think of that?
Oh, it's a lot of fun. It reminds me a little bit of the sword fight in Dune, I guess. Like this, you know, energy swords kind of thing. Okay. I love that Luke has to lose, right? Because he can't be like, oh, I could kick this guy's ass if I wanted to. I love all that. I mean, look, we're halfway through this comic?
Yeah.
Right? Again, I mean, I don't want to be old man waves his hand at the moon of Yavin, but like... Think about how much plot we've already gotten, right? And it's like nowadays, if this was a Star Wars comic, this would be like six issues of story. Like W. Barr, there's a double cross, and then there's like they're faking their identities. We've met these other characters. There's a monster attack. Then the bad guy realizes Luke is right. Like there's so much going on, and there's still more like 10 more pages left to the story.
Normally, when we do these, I just do a much more looser discussion of the issue, but I couldn't with this one because there's so much going on. So you mentioned the bad guys and what they're doing. So Captain Trall here, right? So the female Imperial officer, she pulls Luke outside and uses her feminine wiles. And I mean, there is some seriously suggestive dialogue that is borderline like teaching kids a little more than they bargained for with their 50 cents.
Approved by the Comics Code Authority.
I know. I mean, like there's some here where she literally says, I want you. And like, that's the end of that word balloon. And then later she's kissing on him and she says, I'll be grateful for your help in any number of ways. And then after she totally sticks her tongue all the way to his esophagus, she says, see you tomorrow and tomorrow night. I mean, whoa! Woman knows what she wants, you know, at least. And she's just using him. She plans to kill him anyway. She will do anything to move up in the Empire, I guess. Now, there is one thing that in this the issue that we should probably mention, which is, it's part of the main plot, but is where Luke, he kind of comes across like a jerk. He treats Jedediah, as you mentioned, someone who's, you know, he's got a head injury, right? Brain injury. He's pretty insensitive about it, and he's pretty immature. Like, Luke seems overly annoyed to him, mostly because thinks Jedediah is a mockery. He doesn't think he lives up to what a Jedi is supposed to be in his mind. And it's probably clear that Mark W. Barr, he's trying to show Luke learn a lesson, right? He's trying to show that Luke has judged Jedediah wrong, and that the true qualities a Jedi can show up in unexpected people, and you shouldn't judge somebody by their cover, right? And that's a good idea. It's a good story plot, but it just makes Luke look like a bit of a dick in this story.
Okay.
You didn't get that vibe?
Yeah, I mean, but he's a kid. You know what I mean? Like, he's still a kid. And I like that that's, you know, like, he's still learning things. So, okay. I mean, I agree. But, you know, he's also, like, he's 21-year-old farm boy? Whatever the...
Probably at this point, I would think so. Yeah, because it's been a few years. Yeah.
Yeah,
fair enough. It's unusual to see Luke, our hero that we love so much, not being. I mean, other than I'm going to get some power converters at Tashi Station. Other than
he's very whiny there. Yeah.
Other than that, he's mostly a pretty good guy. So, all right. So the Regent is planning to backstab everyone, and that begets the question: has there ever been a royal regent that wasn't a douche and power hungry and evil? I don't think there's ever been one.
So. It's always they even had that in Super Friends. There was a villain that was the monarch or I forget his name, and his royal consort was like scheming. So yeah, it's always the one you most suspect.
Yes, exactly right. So all right, we gotta talk about Danid and Leia getting it on here. So Luke goes to warn Leia that they're in trouble. He stands outside the window and Danid says, I love you, Leia, marry me and rule with me as my queen. And all she gets out is Danid, he says, hush my love, don't say a word. And then they're lip locked. Mm-hmm. So like, there's a lot of the unpack here. First of all, like, Han's carbonite block isn't even cold yet, okay? Well, I mean, I guess technically it's very cold. But anyway, it just happened. You know, just by these standards, it's probably just a few weeks ago, right? what's your perspective on this? Like, because this goes on for a while. There's more kissing to come. Like, where are you landing on all this with Leia?
You know, when you think of it like that, yeah, it is like, oh, Leia, did you ever tell Han about this? I mean, did he ever hear about it? You know, I think if you want to be charitable, it's like, okay, they are in silhouette. He came in and kissed her, and then like 1 second later, she pushed away. You know, like, oh, no, that kind of thing.
That could very well be. Because, I mean, throughout this story, we never actually get into Leia's head. We get into Luke's head a lot, but we never get into Leia's head. So it could be that she's like, all right, I have to not sleep with him, but I have to lead him on for the sake of the rebellion. Because the whole idea is they need to get this guy on board with the rebels. So maybe she, like you said, maybe she's going to kiss them and go, oh, like, Dennett, I can't, you know, or something demure or something like that. Now, the other creepy thing, and there is literally no mention of Han in this entire issue, by the way. But the thing that bothers them to me is like Luke, as you mentioned earlier, they act like siblings, but Luke gets really upset with her flirting. And I'm thinking actually it's presumably for himself. Like he wants her.
Think so. Yeah. I think he's still, although at this point he's got to know that ship is Sith.
I would hope, but like, wouldn't he be more like, hey, that's my friend's gal. What are you doing? But instead it's like, no, Luke's like, I still got a chance. You know, he's probably not getting out of that carbonite. So I just got to wait it out.
You're saying there's a chance.
All right, well, let's bring it home here. So in the end here, so the next day at the ceremonial space fox hunt to commemorate the return of the prince, things get out of hand. Princess Leia and Prince Daenerys get blasted by his brother, Prince Anod, and Regent Zellor springs the trap. But then the Imperial Captain Trall, she double-crosses the prince, and he goes down. Meanwhile, Luke is throwing down with Regent Zellor, you know, in a sword fight, tapping the force and proving he's no slouch with a blade. Regent Zellor goes down hard. The Imperial Captain Trall lines up a blaster shot at Luke, but the heroic Jedediah swoops in and makes the ultimate sacrifice. With the dust settled, Prince Daenerys takes back the throne and he backs the rebellion, and Luke gives the fallen would-be Jedi a solemn, starbound funeral. So the fox hunt thing here with the frogs, I mean, this is like, I find this genuinely funny. I think I'm supposed to be like wowed, but I just, it's so fun the way it's illustrated and so dorky. I just adore it.
Yeah, it's you know, it's a Star Wars version of something we're familiar with. So, and you know, they're riding these giant frog, like they're like Dubat, you know, like if Kenner had had the license to make toys from the comic, they would have made this toy, right?
Oh,
they
the
would have
made these little frogs. For sure. Yeah.
I would have loved to have had a Jedediah action figure, by the way, with the little stick. That would have been great.
That would have been amazing. Would have been so cool. The headpiece alone. Can you imagine the cast on that thing? Oh wow. So Luke gets pissed off. He's accusing Leia of, you know, kissing on Daenerys, and in fact mentions spin the bottle specifically. So good to know that existed a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
In the Star Wars universe.
It's canon now, baby. It's canon now. So it does get a little confusing in here. Like, you know, Luke pulls a blaster on the Imperial, and then the Regent shoots Luke's gun out of his hand, and then the other prince shoots Leia and Dennett, and then the Imperials shoot the other prince. There's a lot of shooting and backstabbing here, but it's fine. By the end, the important thing is Luke he reaches out with a force, right, to learn his enemy's whereabouts, and Jedediah actually picks up on those signals, comes to save Luke, and he jumps on Captain Trall, which most of us probably would too, quite frankly. But anyway, jumps on her to save Luke, and it gives his life doing it, which is a pretty heroic Jedi-like thing to do, I would say.
I love it. I think it's great.
Yeah. Now, this is something I didn't notice, again, until like this last read-through. Luke is sitting here, you know, he's tuning into the Force. We've got this great panel of all this yellow and pink lines everywhere as he's tuning into the Force, which I really like. I love the visualization of that. I think it looks really cool. But after that moment, when Jedediah senses what Luke is doing, are you on that page by chance?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You see Jedediah, he's like, yes, this place pleases Jedi. It's full of beauty. The minute he picks up on Luke's force signal, he no longer speaks in weird word balloons. All the word balloons instantly look normal. He's got his mental faculties back. And so, you know, he died not only a Jedi, but he died making that choice. He wasn't confused anymore. He kind of had himself back, which is a really nice, subtle move in the lettering that I didn't pick up on until this last read.
Yeah, I don't think all the times I've ever read this book, I ever really thought about that. But yeah, that's right. That's great. What a great detail. Jeez, this book's even better than I remembered it being.
It's like an onion. It's got layers. And then, you know, there's the sword fight. He does kill the Regent guy who totally deserves it.
But, yeah, it's all right. Come on.
But, I mean, so he's fighting the guy. First, he knocks the sword out of his hand. Be thankful I'm not killing you. I'm thankful I'm taking out your sword. And then, later on, when he sneaks up on him, he kills him. And he says, I rarely fight to the death either, Zellor, but to your case, I'll make an exception. It's like, that might be a little bit of dark side, Luke. I'm not sure.
they kill people. What do you say? He kills people willy-nilly in the Star Wars universe. What are you talking about?
But he takes the time to, like, brag and say, I don't usually do this, but for you,
Sure. But I mean, he's full of it. He killed when he's on Jabba's skiff, he's nailing those guys left and right. I mean, come on.
That is true.
How many Weequays died in that sequence?
All right, so the prince has taken the throne. He agrees to back the rebellion. Leia and the prince share another kiss. She's got her hand on his shoulder this time. This is a legit kiss right here, the kiss goodbye, because she's too dedicated to the rebellion. She doesn't mention Han. She's dedicated to the rebellion. Again, I think she's just leading the dude on so he doesn't skip out on the rebellion. And then you get this really nice funeral for Jedediah, which is nice. I love the shot of Luke standing on top of the Y-Wing, the biggest Y-Wing ever, holding the lightsaber. Off to the side, which is kind of like a very cool looking pose. I think that looks great.
I like that Jedediah's ship is clearly on its way to the Genesis planet. That's going to be great. The ending is really well done. I love the bifurcated colors. You know, I love that it's kind of orange on one side and then lighter orange on the other, because it's monochromatic, but it's also meant to, you know, suggest that the lightsaber is emitting some sort of light there. Mm-hmm. But I love the tribute. I love that Luke is like, I'm on my way to this, being part of this very august order, and I take it seriously, and this guy deserves a Viking funeral. So it's a great, really nice ending.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I love it. And I love the ship, the funeral ship that Jedediah is in. It's got kind of like the skull face, sort of like his species, or like Beta Ray Bill. And then I think it's you that likes to mention that, like, as cool as this panel is, with all the suns and the moons, that's not how space works. But that's okay. It still looks really, really cool.
Yeah.
If all those planets were that close to each other, they'd all just smash into each other because of gravity. But anyway.
Like their gravities are slamming into each other. Exactly. Right. It's all right.
But it looks amazing. And then it says Star Wars Spectacular for next issue. Star Wars Spectacular. Giant size 50th issue, The Crimson Forever. Such a good comic. All right. So that's the comic. It's really damn good. I mean, I really enjoyed this quite a bit.
Every so often I would dig it out and kind of reread it, or at least kind of glance at it. I was like, oh, this is so fun. This is so well done. It's a fun adventure. There's some humor in it. We get to meet some other characters in the universe. There's some cool aliens. And then this whole idea of, like, they asked him to be a Jedi and he said no. And then he sort of suffered, you know, this horrible wound. It's great. It's just all around my total winner from Mike W. Barr.
Yeah, it absolutely falls in the camp of space fantasy. I mean, it's very medieval fantasy with the heroic knight who sacrifices himself, all of it, and it works beautifully. Because that is one of the big questions I always ask people as we finish up a comic here, and I'll ask you too. Is this a Star Wars story? Because, you know, sometimes what they do is they really, frankly, they adapt another genre, or in a couple of issues, they adopt another comic entirely. But does this feel like a Star Wars story, or does it feel like some other genre?
No, this feels like this is one of the best examples of writing a Marvel comic, but making it feel like it's fitting in the Star Wars universe.
Yeah, I don't even necessarily see the Marvel Comics, you know, wallpaper there. I see it just as a Star Wars type story, because you're dealing with, yeah, like all the stuff on Jabba's palace. That's stuff, like you said, that we kind of can recognize in our world, but they did it a little space wise. That's the kind of thing here. We can recognize all the fairy tale Camelot type stuff, but it's done with Star Wars flair, and it works. It totally works. So it's good stuff. I don't think I've read this issue maybe once or twice before this, and I'm really glad that we had this chance to dig into it, because it's a great one.
They were on a real run during these issues, right? These they were really thrown at 110 miles an hour.
Well, this is where it starts, because last issue was the banking issue, which, quite frankly, I'm not.
I like that one. I know that you guys really went after it, but we really did. One.
I really do think, and it's not just me. A lot of people agree. I think it's one of the worst Star Wars comics they ever did. and before, the couple ones before that had some shaky ground too. Cody Sunchild, a little bit shaky ground. This one, I think, is the beginning. Like we said, they're no longer telling Marvel stories. They're telling Star Wars stories, because this creative team, I mean, Mike W. Barr's not coming back, obviously, but Walt Simonson and Tom Palmer are going to be the creative team for like 15 issues coming up. And this is the whole reason I wanted to cover these comics, is the run by Michelinie, Simonson, and Palmer. That's, to me, is what Star Wars comics are. And I cannot wait to get to that.
It is a testament to how good an inker Tom Palmer is that I like him inking Walt Simonson, even though Palmer is a very overpowering inker.
Mm-hmm.
He tends to make all of the whoever he's penciling look like his work, because he's just a very strong inker. And I love Simonson so much that I could see in another way I would be like, I don't want that. I want to see Walt Simonson. But it's a beautiful looking book. It's textured. You know, just the ink line is great. As you mentioned, like, you know, the Palmer particularly suffers suffered under newsprint printing because he put a lot of fine line work in his pages, and you really can't see a lot of it here, but it's printed on the crappiest paper imaginable.
As I mentioned earlier, too, a lot of this is Simonson drawing not tight pencils and Palmer doing a lot of the finishes. So I think that's part of the reason that a lot of the characters look like Palmer characters. Like, I think a lot of the other stuff is more Simonson, but when he comes to the faces, Palmer's like, yeah, I'm going to draw my way. And I think that works because he's sort of the connective tissue through this whole Star Wars run. Because even after Simonson leaves and we get people like Ron Frenz and people like that, the characters still look consistent because Tom Palmer is a little bit stronger inker on faces. And Luke continues to look like Luke and et cetera, et cetera. It works really well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I did a little bit of research, a couple of things. Oh, by the way, Tom Palmer, what a nice guy. I got a chance to meet him before he passed away. And I told him how much his Star Wars work meant to me, specifically about issue 50 and things like that. I had a nice talk with him about that. And I guess I'll share that story next month, but or next issue. But what a nice guy. Such a great guy. So sad that he's gone. So I did some research on this particular issue. So this whole world of Velmore, right? This world of castles and all that kind of thing. Wizards of the Coast, who did a Star Wars role-playing game after West End Games, they actually created an online supplement all about the planet of Velmore. They decided to flesh it out, and they've got all these different segments. There's like four or five different chapters all about the games you can do and the aliens and the probably the space frogs are out there. I don't know. But crazy that someone decided to make this issue into part of canon for the role-playing game.
Love it.
Then in 2017, Mark Hamill shared out on social media, he jokingly was begging fans to avoid rereading this comic in advance of the movie The Last Jedi because it had spoilers for the new movie. He was totally pulling their leg.
Really?
Yeah, he really did. I mean, it was tongue-in-cheek. I'm pretty sure people must have known he was kidding, but he's begging fans to avoid reading this comic issue to avoid spoilers. So I think that's hilarious.
I love that Mark Hamill was like even aware of the comic.
He's a big old nerd. He loves comic books.
I know, but like, I don't know. It's just kind of funny. Like, well, all right, no, not aware of the comic. I'm sure he knew there was a comic, but like to this granular level that he knew individual issues and story titles and whatnot. That's funny.
I love it. Walt Simonson. So, you know, he drew this issue, as we said, he's taking over as the regular penciler. He had previously drawn some Star Wars. He drew Star Wars 16, which introduced the Valence the Hunter.
Valence the Hunter.
As well as doing the cover for annual number one. And I didn't know this until I did the research. He actually drew some of those installments in the Pizzazz magazine.
Oh, did he? I thought those were all Inventino.
I haven't validated this myself, but just, again, doing some internet research, that's what I came across, which I found
very
pretty fascinating.
Cool. All right. Yeah. That's awesome.
And Mike W. Barr, you know, one of the things he said about this issue, he said, the plot came out of Luke very much wanting to become a Jedi and how he was always uncertain as to whether he was doing it properly because he had very little guidance. I wanted to explore how Luke would react to a person who had a chance to become a Jedi in the pre-Empire days and turned it down. So that's kind of what Mike W. Barr says guided him to doing this issue. So interesting stuff. And then I got to mention a couple of one's an ad, one's a news article here. So there's an ad, Rob, here for something I believe that's near and dear to your heart. Is that right?
Yes. The second Superman Spider-Man team up as printed in Marvel Treasury Edition number 28. That's significant obviously, just because it's the Superman Spider-Man team up. Although now, of course, that's commonplace. We're seeing them all over the place.
Right now it is. Yeah.
But it is the final issue of Marvel Treasury Edition. It's the 28th and final Marvel Treasury Edition.
Okay. I thought I heard Smurfs was the final Treasury Edition.
That is the final Treasury Marvel ever published.
Oh.
But that was a one-off. This is the Marvel Treasury Edition, the series, which ran 28 issues. This is it. This is the last
one. That makes a lot more sense. Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. And then the bullpen bulletins, normally I wouldn't go into the detail of this, but I have to mention it. There's actually a section on here welcoming Louise Jones, who's our editor on these issues, saying that she's come to them from Warren Magazines. I had to look it up. She'd been with Marvel about 9 months, so I'm not sure why they waited 9 months to announce her welcoming her, but they announce her welcoming. And then they say here that Louise has married Walt Simonson. So a few months ago, Louise Jones and Walt Simonson got married before this point. So now, I don't know when she changes her name from Louise Jones to Louise Simonson, but now we know that Wheezy and Walt are married by the time this issue was done. So that makes me very happy to know.
There weren't that many women in comics at the time, so you got to wonder, like, when Walt closed that deal, the other dudes were like, oh, damn, all right.
Everyone loved Wheezy. I mean, come on.
Exactly. You know, they're like, all right, Walt. All right, grumble, grumble, grumble.
Okay, so I do a thing here also called playing with the new toys, which is all about post-Empire. So basically looking for things that in the story reflected from The Empire Strikes Back specifically. So in this issue, you mentioned it already, Luke mentions his lightsaber worked on the Snow Beast of Hoth. So that's a little callback to Empire. And then also, while he's climbing from balcony to balcony, almost like Spider-Man, he almost falls and he catches himself and he goes, bionic hand, right hand, I love you. So those are your only real mentions are callbacks to Empire at all, or anything that's changed really since the original Star Wars run. And then I also looked ahead at the letters page. So in issue 55 is where they covered all the letters for this particular comic. I wanted to see if there was any 1981 contemporary commentary worth mentioning. It's kind of what you would expect. They're very positive on this issue. They praise the cover. They praise the issue. They comment on the mythical romantic angle of the story and the breathtaking artwork. Several people saying this is the best issue of the series. So there you go. They also mentioned the terrible printing on the issue. And one commenter specifically calls them out, talking about Leia's in love with Han and moved on to Prince Dana too quickly. The editor comes to their defense saying that Leia is burying her feelings for Han right now, so not to jeopardize the rebellion, and that her offer of friendship was misread by Prince Danid and us, the reader. So there the editor was telling us we're seeing things that we're not seeing. So there we go.
All right, calm down, nerds.
All right, Rob, now it is time for
the Golden Pliff Award.
This is where we nominate our favorite moment from the issues, whether it is a story beat, something in the art, some aspect of Star Wars lore that's exciting to us, you know, whatever. Both myself and Rob are going to pick one moment each to spotlight, and that moment will earn a Golden Pliff Award. And if you're unaware, this award is named for the single greatest Star Wars character of all time, Pliff the Hoojib, but you'll learn more about him in coming episodes. Rob, you're the guest. Why don't you tell us your pick for the Golden Pliff Award?
I guess I think Jedediah saving the day is probably too big of a moment, so I'll go with something a little smaller. I just love those last three panels of Luke standing on the ship, raising his and doing a big Viking salute to Jedediah. I just think that's it's really very touching.
It really is. It's very good. It's the feel moment of the or feels with a Z moment.
You can hear
of
the John
issue.
Williams music swelling. You know
exactly
the whole thing.
Exactly. So I had two kind of in mind. That was one of them. So I will definitely go with my other pick, which is just that first page, that splash page of the Y-Wing. You know, it's making a statement. It's saying that, you know, no offense to Carmen, you're going to get screen accurate ships now. You're going to get, you know, this incredible effect, this crazy angle, this amazing Star Wars shot of the moon and the planet and all that. And it just really striking. We spent a lot of time talking about it. So yeah, my pick is going to be the Y-Wing shot in the beginning. So congratulations to both moments. You have both won a coveted Golden Pliff Award. Please display it in a place of pride. So, all right, now, Rob, I need to ask a favor. Would you mind hanging around here for a little bit and help me by maybe rounding up all these space frogs? And if it works easier for you, you could actually ride the space frogs around if that helps.
I'm just going to sit here and play with your Death Star playset and the Dianoga toy because I haven't seen that in a long time.
Fair enough. All right, no worries. Now, don't worry, Rob, we will bring you back at the end of the show. But after this podcast promo break, I'm going to read your listener feedback in a segment called Star Words.
Attention, attention all personnel. New from the Fire and Water Podcast Network, it's MASHcast. Hosted by MASH mega fan Rob Kelly and a rotating cast of VIPs, MASHcast analyzes episode by episode the greatest television series of all time, MASH. Find MASHcast on fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Maybe I can do a podcast about comic books. No, everybody does a podcast about comic books. Maybe I can do a podcast about TV shows. Now, there's a lot of podcasts out there covering TV shows. I know a podcast about movies. It's too general. A lot of people do podcasts about movies. Star Wars movies. No, everybody talks about Star Wars movies. I need to do a podcast that covers movies and television shows and comics and all the pop culture I loved growing up. Wait a minute. The Pop Culture Basement Podcast, hosted by me, Mike Jamison, covering all of the pop culture that I consumed and that we consumed during our formative years. Now available on all reputable podcast platforms. Join us down in the basement.
Star Words.
Star Words is the segment of the show where we cover your feedback from the previous episode and is named for the letter column in these classic Marvel Star Wars comics. Now, in the spirit of this being released on May the 4th, why don't you let us know in the comments how you celebrated this Star Wars Day? We'd love to hear that. Now, folks, out on social media, also, you can find where we posted lots of the images that we talked about in this episode today. So check out Empire to Jedi social media posts from the past week, because as I always say, it's about building a community of online Star Wars fans around the show. Now, I do have a request. If you haven't left an iTunes or Apple Podcast review, please consider it. It does really help raise the profile of the show and attract new listeners, and quite frankly, there are a gazillion, that is actually the technical term, a gazillion Star Wars podcasts out there. So we are lost in the sea of a tremendous number of fantastic Star Wars podcasts. So anything you can do to help raise attention about our show would be greatly appreciated. And if you do that, I will read your entire review on the air. So all you gotta do is look on iTunes or Apple Podcasts for Marvel Star Wars From Empire to Jedi. Now, I have collected all of your comments from the Fire and Water Podcast Network website and any emails, and I put it all in one big Google document. It is very, very long, so I can't read every word. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to acknowledge every single person that left a comment on our website and read a portion of their comments. Now, if you want your thoughts read on a future episode, be sure to leave that on our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com/EmpireToJedi. Now, what we'll be doing here is we're going to be covering our last episode on Star Wars number 48 with Princess Leia facing down Darth Vader on the banking world with my guest Henry Bernstein. First up is Nate the Great, who says, I don't love this cover. The Leia half is good. Darth Vader looks like he lost his mask and had to borrow the shredders. However, now I'm picturing Princess Leia battling Count Chocula. What a thought. The plot of this sounds like a random sci-fi channel movie or a Green Lantern comic. Oh, Nate, you made me laugh. I appreciate that. Then we heard from some guy named Rob Kelly for the Firewater Podcast Network. He apparently has shows such as Fade Out and Mashcast. Other than that, quite frankly, I've never even heard of this guy. Let's see what he's got to say. He says, quote, show me on the 12-inch Chewbacca doll where this comic touched you. I think you guys were a little harsh on this issue, one that I've always enjoyed, even though, yeah, the premise that Leia could interact with Vader with impunity is ridiculous. He would just take out his lightsaber, slash her in two, and story over. As a kid reading the comic as it came out, I had some dim appreciation that Marvel was limited as to what they could do in between the movies. So seeing two of the big characters directly interact was a real treat. Maybe if I dug out the comic and reread it, that it would change. So I won't be doing that. Well, thank you, random stranger, Rob Kelly. Then we're from Movie Matt Sorois from the TV Movie Rewind podcast. Matt says, first things first, congratulations on making the episode far more entertaining and enjoyable than the comic it was about. That was a really fun listen. And he says, as ridiculous as the premise seems, there's some actual validity to it. During the American Civil War, there were Confederate states with their own banks and economies. Sure, Emperor Palpatine had declared himself ruler of the galaxy, but there was undoubtedly planets that did not recognize his authority. It would make sense that the rich and powerful planet may, in fact, back the alliance. There would not only be potential monetary gain, but also political gain should the Rebel Alliance win. Not to mention Princess Leia was still, in fact, a princess. She would still have powerful allies and hidden wealth that the banking planet might want to curry favor with. That being said, this story was a terrible idea for a comic book. What Star Wars fan cared about cosmic loans? It would have been way over my head when this issue hit the stands. I believe I've read this one once back in the 1990s when I'd gone back to pick up all the Marvel Star Wars issues I skipped when they originally came out. I skimmed over the story before listening, but I just couldn't get myself to read it. One last observation. While we didn't know Vader and Leia were father and daughter when the story was written, had she known of their relationship, would she have asked him to co-sign the loan? You know, quite possibly, Matt. Quite possibly. They were from Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. He says, this comic sounds like a filler, but I feel like this is something you'd have to have Leia do, because let's face it, of the named main cast, she's probably the only one who you could use for a banking story. Luke probably knows nothing about banking. That's a good point, Bucky. I appreciate that. Then Bucky goes on to write his own sort of fan fiction about Star Wars and Sonic the Hedgehog. You can check that out over at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Then we heard from Sean Ross from the Fire & Water Podcast Network. He hosts a show called Peace Bound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast. Sean says, great episode. I'm so glad that you call out the wonky anatomy for Leia on the cover. In particular, it looks like she's twisting her body because she's pooping out an old man. What kind of food do they eat in Alderaan? I didn't want to think about that, Sean. Then he says, sometimes the best episodes come when covering the worst issues, and this is the case here. You two are clearly having so much fun that it made for a really fun listen. Well, thanks, Sean. Then we heard from Mark Baker Wright from Black Rock's Toy Box and Not Your Father's Autobot podcast. Mark says, thanks to Henry, I'm now expecting a new line of t-shirts in your merch store with a logo proclaiming, quote, another childhood ruined by the irredeemable Shag. You know, Mark, you're appealing to my vanity there, and now I really want to make that shirt. Then we heard from Ryan Prinky. He says, do you think this story was written and drawn prior to the release of Empire? Because that's sure what it feels like. You know, Ryan, it does feel like that. But there's one thing in here, which is Vader blocking the laser blast with his hand. That's definitely from Empire. So it does make me wonder if maybe the story was written before Empire, but drawn afterwards. So it's food for thought there. Then over on social media, Alan Boyce Jr. Shared something, which was a callback to the previous episode. He shared an image of RoboCop, you know, Peter Weller, without his helmet, and it really does look like the character of Kligson from Droid World issue, and he's really right. So, well, good call, Alan. Then we heard from Chuck Bushman, who says, this was a great show, a bad comic, but a great show. Well, thank you, Chuck. Then we heard from Tim Price from the Outcasters Under Siege, an Avengers podcast, Huntress podcast, and more on the Right On Network. Tim says, the main thing I got from this issue was a reminder of how hardcore Leia is. It's baked into her character, so it's not like I forgot that. But it's one thing to zap stormtroopers with your blaster, and another to send one guy to the center of the planet and squash a second who was a butterfly. I'm sorry, but damn. Just shows again how awesome she is. You're not wrong, Tim. You're not wrong. They were from John Stye, past guest of my JSA in the 90s podcast. John says, another fun episode about a Star Wars comic that I'd never read. Shag and Henry make it sound interesting enough in a Mystery Science Theater 3000 way that I now want to read it. And as a true Red, White, and Blue fan of G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, Larry Hama can do no wrong in my eyes. Wait, he's responsible for Bucky O'Hare, who might actually be related to Jackson? Oh, Larry, just stick to Snake Eye, Scarlet, and Company. I mean, nothing spells Star Wars to me like taking out a space loan. And the twist ending within the twist ending between Vader and Leia makes it sound even more confusing. Regardless, thanks for the chuckles. Glad you enjoyed it, John, and thanks for sharing our podcast across so many social media platforms. Appreciate it. Then from Damian Drouet-Whiter, formerly of the Should I Love This Comic podcast and past guest of my JLI podcast. Damian's always great dropping the knowledge bomb, so he drops a great one here. He says, hi, Shag. I've been a bit remiss in commenting recently, so I'm going to cover my thoughts on the last two episodes in one go, starting with the droid world in the fantastic cover. You seem surprised that Frank Miller was drawing a Star Wars cover, but it's slightly less surprising when you remember that in the early 1980s, he was a member of the Upstart Associates, where he shared a studio with Howard Chaykin, cover inker James Sherman, and Walter Simonson, who was about to take over as a Star Wars artist and was married to the editor of the issue, Louise Jones. That's quite a connection. Wow, Damien, I never realized that Frank was so connected with those guys at the time, and it makes perfect sense then that if he was doing a Star Wars cover through those connections. Well, thank you. Damon says, on to the third law, Larry Hama can join J.M. DeMatteis in being a great writer who wasn't good at writing Star Wars. I suppose we shouldn't be surprised that he wrote a finance-based comic, as his 1980s Bullpen Bulletins profile said his ultimate ambition in comics was to write an Uncle Scrooge McDuck story. I'm telling you, man, you know the most amazing stuff. Then Damian goes on to say, these two issues and the Cody Sunchild issue are a great display of the role of an inker. Seeing how different Infantino's work looks inked by Tom Palmer, Gene Day, and Carlos Garzon shows just how much of an inker influences the look of the comic. I'm glad to say that it's my favorite of those who goes on to be the regular inker of the rest of the Empire to Jedi run, as we're going to get some of the best art to ever appear in comics. You're not wrong there. Tom Palmer is amazing. He says, I initially read most of this era in Marvel's UK Return of the Jedi Weekly, which reprinted at a larger size and mostly in black and white, so you could really see the majesty of Tom Palmer's work. I'm so looking forward to rereading the Crimson Forever and then the Michelini, Simonson, Palmer issues along with you, which are among my favorite comics of all time. I am right there with you, Damien, totally. So glad you're feeling that way. All right, folks, this is the part of the show where I thank everyone who shared our show on their social media timeline. That means Facebook, Blue Sky, X, or Twitter, Instagram, and Threads. I do realize this is a long list of names. However, these folks showed their support and promoted the show, so it's important to me that we recognize these individuals. This time out, we got nearly 70 people who helped promote the show recently. And I want to be clear here, it's actually a much bigger number. But Facebook has changed their programming, so now I can't see who shares the posts on Facebook. If I can catch it in the notifications when it pops in there, I can grab it. Otherwise, it's gone. So I apologize. I know I'm missing a bunch of people from Facebook, but I can't capture back those names. So I'm sorry. I'm going to do a better job of keeping my eye on the notifications now, I suppose. And also, Instagram is being a bit of a pain as well. They're owned by the same company. A little bit of logic there. Anyway, you could be on this list next episode. It's just as easy by sharing, retweeting, or whatever it's called on Facebook, Blue Sky, X or Twitter, Instagram, or Threads. And again, I am going to do my absolute best to catch every single name next time. So my apologies to those I missed. But our thanks go out to AJ Walden, Alan Boyce Jr., Andy Capellish, Iquilgia Hybrida, Astro at Blue Ace 1878, Bad Hutch, Bailey Planet, Bill Mudrin, Billy D in his Magazines and Monsters, Black Vulcan 69, Brett Young, Katarina, CEO of Ventress, Corellian Pirate, Craig Oxbro, D. Kennedy at Detective 38, Damian Drew A. Whiter, Dan Dougherty, Death Cab for Zoe, Dr. Chris Lewis, Drew at Drew 96, Emma at Emph's Nest, Ezer Z, Everything, Not Really, GCII Messy, Griff, H.J. Watson, Hack, Mike in Morning, Henry Bernstein, H.G. Wells, J. David Weeder, James Coruscant, Diner of Three, Jeff Poyer, John Stibe, Keen Comics, Lava Castle, Lizanne Oswald, M. Cipher, Mark Baker Wright, Matt Saroyce, Mike Jameson and his Pop Culture Basement and Sleazebag Cinema accounts, Mike Thomas, Mommy Marshall Heidi, Mr. Hot Dog, Nick from Toy Foo, Normal Gamer, Pablo Hidalgo, Pale Blurs, Relina Warcraft, Ryan Daly and his Batman Nightcast account, Scott X, Soul Nova, Ali's Rack, Star Wars Splash Page, Stephen E. Shend, TFPFOZ, That Giffen Show, Tim Price and his Outcasters Under Siege and Avengers podcast account, Tom Chansky, Trey Lawson, Venkman, and Cap Boots. Wow, my thanks to all of you for your support of the Empire to Jedi podcast. I truly believe that listener feedback is a critical part of the show, and this community of Star Wars fans we built together are absolutely fantastic. Now, if I've forgotten or missed anyone, I am terribly sorry. It is probably the fault of Henry Bernstein or, as I mentioned, Facebook and Instagram being turds. I do my best to find all your social media comments, but sometimes they do slip through my fingers. So please, keep those cards and letters coming. You can visit our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com/EmpireToJedi. Leave your comments on the show post there, and our fellow Star Wars fans can share thoughts and communicate with you together. Now, speaking of interacting with listeners, you can also find us on social media. We're on several platforms as Empire to Jedi, including Facebook, Blue Sky, X or Twitter, Instagram, and Threads. You can email us at EmpireToJedi@gmail.com. My thanks again to you listeners, honestly, for such a great collection of feedback, and I really want to wish you a very happy May the 4th. Now, we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we'll see how this episode's guest, Rob Kelly, handled my childhood Star Wars trash compactor monster.
Across the DC multiverse, countless worlds exist in parallel, each with its own history, its own heroes, its own destiny. But before you can visit the worlds, you have to understand the map. I'm DC Dave, and this is Infinite Earths, a guide to the DC multiverse. In Season 1, we explore the architecture of the multiverse itself, the shifting cosmic designs that have defined DC history for decades. From the earliest experiments in parallel Earths to the sweeping restructurings that reshaped reality, we trace how the multiverse was built, broken, and rebuilt again. This is your field guide to the foundations of infinite possibility. The Orrery is waiting. Let's explore.
It's Fade Out. Hosted by film fanatic Rob Kelly and a roster of special guests, Fade Out will examine the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
All right, folks, we're back from break, and yes, we've got Rob back with us. Now, Rob, thank you so much for appearing on this episode of the show. It's been an absolute blast talking with you. I mean, obviously, I get to talk with you more than I do with most people, but this has been super fun having you on my show over at my house. And by the way, use a coaster. Don't be a savage. But it's been so much fun having you here. Why don't you tell the listeners where they can find more of you on the internets?
Well, thank you for having me, Shag. I was a little worried that this was going to be like one of those issues of Brave and the Bold where it's like, Batman's guest star is Superman. You're like, oh, all right. I see that all the time. Like, you know, like, oh, but I think we did it. I think we did an okay job. And we did a proper salute to this really great comic. Yes, I can be found all over the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm working on MASHcast at the moment, doing middle of season 8. And I do Fade Out every month. And of course, you and I do Who's Who every so often.
Yep. We've got one coming out at the end of May here. So this month. Should be a pretty good episode. So check out that, folks. Yep. Well, thank you again, Rob. I really appreciate it. Now, that's going to do it, folks. Come back in 2 months for the next episode when we cover Marvel Star Wars number 50, possibly the single greatest comic of all time. Yes, I am throwing down the gauntlet. It is superior to Justice League of America number 200. I will brook no arguments. And for that issue, I will be joined by a fantastic guest to help me cover the issue. Who will it be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Rob. And may the Force be with you.
Always.